This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. From the North American Review, February 1, 1907, Chapters from My Autobiography, Chapter 11, by Mark Twain. Dictated March 28, 1906. About 1849 or 1850, Orion severed his connection with a printing house in St. Louis and came up to Hannibal, and bought a weekly paper called the Hannibal Journal, together with its plant and its goodwill, for the sum of $500 cash. He borrowed the cash at 10% interest from an old farmer named Johnson who lived 5 miles out of town. Then he reduced the subscription price of the paper from $2 to $1. He reduced the rates for advertising in about the same proportion, and thus he created one absolute and unassailable certainty, to wit, that the business would never pay him a single cent of profit. He took me out of the courier office and engaged my services in his own at $3.50 a week, which was an extravagant wage, but Orion was always generous and always liberal with everybody except himself. It cost him nothing in my case, for he never was able to pay me a penny as long as I was with him. By the end of the first year he found he must make some economies. The office rent was cheap, but it was not cheap enough. He could not afford to pay rent of any kind, so he moved the whole plant into the house we lived in, and it cramped the dwelling space cruelly. He kept that paper alive during 4 years, and I have at this time no idea how he accomplished it. Toward the end of each year he had to turn out and scrape and scratch for the $50 of interest due Mr. Johnson, and at that $50 was about the only cash he ever received or paid out, I suppose, while he was proprietor of that newspaper, except for ink and printing paper. The paper was a dead failure. It had to be that from the start. Finally, he handed it over to Mr. Johnson and went up to Muscatine, Iowa, and acquired a small interest in a weekly newspaper there. It was not a sort of property to marry on, but no matter. He came across a winning and pretty girl who lived in Quincy, Illinois, a few miles below Keokuk, and they became engaged. He was always falling in love with girls, but by some accident or other he had never gone so far as engagement before. And now he achieved nothing but misfortune by it, because he straightway fell in love with a Keokuk girl. He married the Keokuk girl, and they began a struggle for life, which turned out to be a difficult enterprise and very unpromising. To gain a living in Muscatine was plainly impossible, so Orion and his new wife went to Keokuk to live, for she wanted to be near her relatives. He bought a little bit of a job-printing plant, on credit, of course, and at once put prices down to where not even the apprentices could get a living out of it, and this sort of a thing went on. I had not joined the Muscatine migration. Just before that happened, which I think was in 1853, I disappeared one night and fled to St. Louis. There I worked in the composing room of the Evening News for a time, and then started on my travels to see the world. The world was New York City, and there was a little World's Fair there. It had just been opened where the great reservoir afterward was, and where the sumptuous public library is now being built, Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street. I arrived in New York with $2 or $3 in pocket change and a $10 bank bill concealed in the lining of my coat. I got work at villainous wages in the establishment of John A. Gray and Green in Cliff Street, and I found board in a sufficiently villainous mechanics boarding house in Duane Street. The firm paid my wages in wildcat money at its face value, and my week's wage merely sufficed to pay board and lodging. By and by I went to Philadelphia and worked there some months as a sub on the Inquirer and the Public Ledger. Finally, I made a flying trip to Washington to see the sights there, and in 1854 I went back to the Mississippi Valley, sitting upright in the smoking car 2 or 3 days and nights. When I reached St. Louis, I was exhausted. I went to bed on board a steamboat that was bound for Muscatine. I fell asleep at once with my clothes on and didn't wake again for 36 hours. I worked in that little job office in Keokuk as much as 2 years, I should say, without ever collecting a cent of wages, for Orion was never able to pay anything. But Dick Higgum and I had good times. I don't know what Dick got, but it was probably only uncashable promises. One day in the midwinter of 1856 or 1857, I think it was 1856, I was coming along the main street of Keokuk in the middle of the forenoon. It was bitter weather, so bitter that the street was deserted almost. A light dry snow was blowing here and there on the ground and on the pavement, swirling this way and that way, and making all sorts of beautiful figures, but very chilly to look at. The wind blew a piece of paper past me, and it lodged against a wall of a house. Something about the look of it attracted my attention, and I gathered it in. It was a $50 bill, the only one I had ever seen, and the largest assemblage of money I had ever encountered in one spot. I advertised it in the papers, and suffered more than $1,000 worth of solicitude and fear and distress during the next few days, lest the owner should see the advertisement and come and take my fortune away. As many as 4 days went by without an applicant. Then I could endure this kind of misery no longer. I felt sure that another 4 could not go by in this safe and secure way. I felt that I must take that money out of danger. So I bought a ticket for Cincinnati and went to that city. I worked there several months in the printing office of Wrightson and Company. I had been reading Lieutenant Herndon's account of his explorations of the Amazon, and had been mightily attracted by what he said of coca. I made up my mind that I would go to the headwaters of the Amazon and collect coca and trade in it and make a fortune. I left for New Orleans in the steamer Paul Jones with this great idea filling my mind. One of the pilots of that boat was Horace Bixby. Little by little I got acquainted with him, and pretty soon I was doing a lot of steering for him in his daylight watches. When I got to New Orleans, I inquired about ships leaving for Para, and discovered that there weren't any, and learned that there probably wouldn't be any during that century. It had not occurred to me to inquire about these particulars before leaving Cincinnati, so there I was. I couldn't get to the Amazon. I had no friends in New Orleans, and no money to speak of. I went to Horace Bixby and asked him to make a pilot out of me. He said he would do it for $100 cash in advance. So I steered for him up to St. Louis, borrowed the money from my brother-in-law, and closed the bargain. I had acquired this brother-in-law several years before. This was Mr. William A. Moffat, a merchant, a Virginian, a fine man in every way. He had married my sister Pamela, and the Samuel E. Moffat of whom I have been speaking was their son. Within 18 months I became a competent pilot, and I served that office until the Mississippi River traffic was brought to a standstill by the breaking out of the Civil War. Meantime, Orion had gone down the river and established his little job printing office in Keokuk. On account of charging next to nothing for the work done in his job office, he had almost nothing to do there. He was never able to comprehend that work done on a profitless basis deteriorates, and is presently not worth anything, and that customers are then obliged to go where they can get better work, even if they must pay better prices for it. He had plenty of time, and he took up Blackstone again. He also put up a sign which offered his services to the public as a lawyer. He never got a case, in those days, nor even an applicant, although he was quite willing to transact law business for nothing and furnish the stationery himself. He was always liberal that way. Presently he moved to a wee little hamlet called Alexandria, 2 or 3 miles down the river, and he put up that sign there. He got no custom. He was by this time very hard ground. But by this time I was beginning to earn a wage of $250 a month as pilot, and so I supported him thenceforth until 1861, when his ancient friend Edward Bates, then a member of Mr. Lincoln's first cabinet, got him the place of secretary of the new territory of Nevada, and Orion and I cleared for that country in the overland stagecoach. I paid the fares, which were pretty heavy, and carrying with me what money I had been able to save, this was $800, I should say, and it was all in silver coin, and a good deal of a nuisance because of its weight. And we had another nuisance, which was an unabridged dictionary. It weighed about 1,000 pounds, and was a ruinous expense, because the stagecoach company charged for extra baggage by the ounce. We could have kept a family for a time on what that dictionary cost in the way of extra freight, and it wasn't a good dictionary anyway. Didn't have any modern words in it, only had obsolete ones that they used to use when Noah Webster was a child. The government of the new territory of Nevada was an interesting menagerie. Governor Nye was an old and seasoned politician from New York. Politician, not statesman. He had white hair, he was in fine physical condition, he had a winningly friendly face and deep, lustrous brown eyes that could talk as a native language the tongue of every feeling, every passion, every emotion. His eyes could out-talk his tongue, and this is saying a good deal, for he was a very remarkable talker, both in private and on the stump. He was a shrewd man. He generally saw through surfaces and perceived what was going on inside without being suspected of having an eye on the matter. When grown-up persons indulge in practical jokes, the fact gauges them. They have lived narrow, obscure, and ignorant lives, and at full manhood they still retain and cherish a job lot of leftover standards and ideals that would have been discarded with their boyhood if they had then moved out into the world in a broader life. There were many practical jokers in the new territory. I do not take pleasure in exposing this fact, for I liked those people. But what I am saying is true. I wish I could say a kindlier thing about them instead, that they were burglars or hat-rack thieves or something like that. That wouldn't be utterly uncomplimentary. I would prefer it, but I can't say those things. They would not be true. These people were practical jokers, and I will not try to disguise it. In other respects, they were plenty good enough people, honest people, reputable and likable. They played practical jokes upon each other with success, and got the admiration and applause, and also the envy of the rest of the community. Naturally, they were eager to try their arts on big game, and that was what the governor was. But they were not able to score. They made several efforts, but the governor defeated these efforts without any trouble, and went on smiling his pleasant smile as if nothing had happened. Finally, the joker chiefs of Carson City and Virginia City conspired together to see if their combined talent couldn't win a victory, for the jokers were getting into a very uncomfortable place. The people were laughing at them instead of at their proposed victim. They banded themselves together to the number of 10 and invited the governor to what was a most extraordinary attention in those days, pickled oyster stew and champagne, luxuries very seldom seen in that region, and existing rather as fabrics of the imagination than as facts. The governor took me with him. He said despairingly, "It's a poor invention. It doesn't deceive. Their idea is to get me drunk and leave me under the table, and from their standpoint this will be very funny. But they don't know me. I am familiar with champagne, and have no prejudices against it." The fate of the joke was not decided until 2 o'clock in the morning. At that hour the governor was serene, genial, comfortable, contented, happy, and sober, although he was so full that he couldn't laugh without shedding champagne tears. Also at that hour the last joker joined his comrades under the table, drunk to the last perfection. The governor remarked, "This is a dry place, Sam. Let's go and get something to drink and go to bed." The governor's official menagerie had been drawn from the humblest ranks of his constituents at home, harmless good fellows who had helped in his campaigns, and now they had their reward in petty salaries payable in greenbacks that were worth next to nothing. Those boys had a hard time to make both ends meet. Orion's salary was $1,800 a year, and he couldn't even support his dictionary on it. But the Irish woman who had come out on the governor's staff charged the menagerie only $10 a week apiece for board and lodging. Orion and I were of her boarders and lodgers, and so, on these cheap terms, the silver I had brought from home held out pretty well. At first, I roamed about the country seeking silver, but at the end of 62, or at the beginning of 63, when I came up from Aurora's to begin a journalistic life on the Virginia City Enterprise, I was presently sent down to Carson City to report the legislative session. Orion was soon very popular with the members of the legislature, because they found that whereas they couldn't usually trust each other, nor anybody else, they could trust him. He easily held the belt for honesty in that country, but it didn't do him any good in a pecuniary way, because he had no talent for either persuading or scaring legislators. But I was differently situated. I was there every day in the legislature to distribute compliment and censure with evenly balanced justice, and spread the same over a half a page of the Enterprise every morning. Consequently, I was an influence. I got the legislature to pass a wise and very necessary law requiring every corporation doing business in the territory to record its charter in full, without skipping a word, in a record to be kept by the Secretary of the Treasury, my brother. All the charters were framed in exactly the same words. For this record service, he was authorized to charge 40 cents a folio of 100 words for making the record. Also, $5 for furnishing a certificate of each record, and so on. Everybody had a toll road franchise, but no toll road. But the franchise had to be recorded and paid for. Everybody was a mining corporation and had to have himself recorded and pay for it. Very well, we prospered. The Record Service paid an average of $1,000 a month in gold. Governor Nye was often absent from the territory. He liked to run down to San Francisco every little while and enjoy a rest from territorial civilization. Nobody complained, for he was prodigiously popular. He had been a stage driver in his early days in New York or New England, and had acquired the habit of remembering names and faces and of making himself agreeable to his passengers. As a politician, this had been invaluable to him, and he kept his arts in good condition by practice. By the time he had been governor a year, he had shaken hands with every human being in the territory of Nevada, and after that he always knew these people instantly at sight and could call them by name. The whole population of 20,000 persons were his personal friends, and he could do anything he chose to do and count upon their being contented with it. Whenever he was absent from the territory, which was generally, Orion served his office in his place as acting governor, a title which was soon and easily shortened to governor. He recklessly built and furnished a house at a cost of $12,000, and there was no other house in the sagebrush capital that could approach this property for style and cost. When Governor Nye's four-year term was drawing to a close, the mystery of why he had ever consented to leave the great state of New York and help inhabit that jackrabbit desert was solved. He had gone out there in order to become a United States senator. All that was now necessary was to turn the territory into a state. He did it without any difficulty. That undeveloped country and that sparse population were not well fitted for the heavy burden of a state government, but no matter, the people were willing to have the change, and so the governor's game was made. Orion's game was made, too, apparently, for he was as popular because of his honesty as the governor was for more substantial reasons. But at the critical moment, the inborn capriciousness of his character rose up without warning, and disaster followed. Mark Twain, to be continued.